Welcome to episode 3 of Bookish Beginnings. Hi, I'm Natasha.
And I'm Catherine.
So we are two Charlotte Mason homeschooling moms discussing both philosophy and application in our daily lives, educating our children. Today, we are going to be discussing old versus new literature. Is one superior to the other? And what would Charlotte Mason think about it? So before we jump into that topic, what have you been reading lately?
Well, a book I recently finished is Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. This is one of my favorite classics. Jane has a very difficult beginning to her life and ends up in a really harsh school meant to bring up poor children for labor, service. She struggles there for many years, but the situation eventually improves with a change in the leadership after a typhus outbreak, and this takes her best friend. When she completes her education, she leaves the school to work as a governess at Thornfield. Here she meets a brooding, dark man of mystery, Mr. Rochester. Strange things start to happen in the manor, fires set, and odd laughter echoing in the night. Jane is a bright, independent-minded young woman. She and Rochester spend many evenings in discussion by the fire. Jane begins to feel her heart stirring towards this rough Rochester. However, a wealthy young lady, Blanche, arrives at Thornfield to stay, and Jane realizes that though she may be intelligent and Rochester seems to delight in their time together, she's poor and not beautiful. She thinks herself foolish for even considering the possibility of marriage to this gentleman. I won't give any more away, but if you like Victorian Gothic romance as much as I do, this might be the one to pick up. A quote I really liked from chapter 29 is, "Prejudices, it is well known, are most difficult to eradicate from the heart, whose soil's never been loosened or fertilized by education. They grow there, firm as weeds, among stones."
I loved that book. I am reading The Unpleasantness at the Bologna Club by Dorothy Sayers. It's one of those Lord Peter Wimsey murder mysteries set just before World War I. Lord Peter Wimsey, he's not quite a detective in the truest of senses. He's just a private citizen, but he is known for being gifted with his sleuthing abilities. At the beginning of the book, Wimsey arrives at the Bologna Club to meet his friend, George Fentiman. George Fentiman is a war veteran. He can no longer work due to his injuries, and he admits to Wimsey that he's struggling financially and that it bothers him that he has to depend on his wife for financial support. Suddenly, they discover the elder General Fentiman, George's grandfather, is dead in his armchair at the club. They attempt to contact his estranged sister, Lady Dormer. However, it was discovered that she also died on the very same day. The family solicitor, Mr. Merbles, asks Lord Peter to investigate which of them died first, because the terms of Lady Dormer's will means that if she died first, Robert and George Fentiman will inherit a fortune. However, if General Fentiman died first, the money would go to a lady named Anne Dorland, who was a distant relative of Lady Dormer and acted as her companion. Of course, what begins as a simple investigation to discover the time of General Fentiman's death becomes a much more involved and complicated affair. Wimsey reminds me of a turn-of-the-century but eccentric and refined Columbo, and the rest of Sayers' characters are equally unique and entertaining. This was a really fun read. There were so many witty quotes in this book, but I chose this one that I thought would suit our discussion today. Lord Wimsey says, "Books, you know, Charles, are like lobster shells. We surround ourselves with them, then we grow out of them and leave them behind as evidences of our earlier stages of development."
That's hilarious. We have lobster shells all over our house.
So on to today's topic. In recent years, schools and governments have been banning many of the loved classic literary works while embracing newer written works with very, I can only say, different perspectives.
Good.
Yet many homeschooling families continue to hold on to the cherished classics and reject much of modern literature. Mm-hmm. I was recently asked about our Charlotte Mason book selection for this coming year. And when I told them that it was a good mix of both old and new literature, which I thought was a really great combination, it pretty much ended the conversation with this homeschooling mom. She just said that modern books and modern thought contain too much opinion and not enough truth. Mm-hmm. For me, the first thing that came to my mind when she said this was that really all literary writing, other than the Bible, is really informed by opinion and bias, and yet there's still much to learn from it. Mm-hmm. I thought this would make an interesting topic for today's podcast, especially since there'll be book recommendations.
Yes.
So what do you think? Should we attempt this subject?
Oh, I don't know. It's going to be a spicy one.
I hope so. Today, we're going to tackle this ongoing debate of old versus new literature. In particular, what Charlotte Mason would say about all of this. I think this topic really contains two separate questions here. One, should old books be banned? And two, is there any value in modern literature?
Yeah, I think book banning has been a topic that's not only contained in our little community of Charlotte Mason educators, but I've been talking to public school educators, neighbors, and I see it all the time debated on the news.
Yeah, I read recently in this past week that public schools in Alberta were adding four more books to their banned list. Two of them was To Kill a Mockingbird and Of Mice and Men. I found that so sad.
That is so sad. Those are two books I really love. In today's culture, we do have a specific frame of reference we're working from. And I think that we're vulnerable to forgetting that we have a wider access to differing experiences, like if we're seeking them. But with this abundance of resources, we're sort of getting a certain amount of arrogance. I've observed some arrogance in our current era. It seems to be like we have completely sorted out this inclusion, exclusion question, and we are so evolved and we no longer do or say anything offensive. But let's be realistic. We've always been offensive and we likely always will be offensive. That is simply the state of man since the fall, is it not? No amount of erasing our history or banning our books is going to change that.
I could not agree more. In fact, the Bible can be considered quite offensive to some people, and some awful events have been recorded in it. Rather than just discussing all that is lovely and good, the Bible highlights just how fallen we are, and every single generation is fallen, including ours. So it's important to read because it helps us, and it helps really humanity, to work towards improving, to seeing our flaws and wanting to be better. Though the Bible is held at a different standard than many books, when we read about hatred and justice and racism, we aren't drawn to it. We are repelled by it and we want to do better. Many parents fear that if their children see bad things, they will naturally be drawn to it and do the same.
Yeah, that's really true. Reading prejudice in context, though, with consequences, I think it allows us to recognize that hatred and really to do better in our lives. Charlotte Mason's 19th principle is that a person's chief responsibility is to accept or reject ideas. She says, therefore, children should be taught, as they become mature enough to understand such teaching, that the chief responsibility which rests on them as persons is the acceptance or rejection of ideas. To help them in this choice, we give them principles of conduct and a wide range of the knowledge fitted to them. Charlotte Mason believed that knowledge and principles would be gained by reading a large number of good books and discussing them. Are we not weakening society by withholding these good ideas just because we don't like a perspective which is actually accurate for that era?
I definitely agree. Simply having a list of do's and don'ts, they don't help our children learn right from wrong. Sometimes we don't recognize what is good unless it's contrasted with what isn't. Sheltering our kids from everything doesn't strengthen their values and beliefs, and they really have no other basis for their beliefs other than, my mother told me so.
Yeah, exactly. By bubble wrapping our kids and removing high quality books, because in this day and age we hold different viewpoints, makes our kids vulnerable because they miss out on opportunities to discern. So we both agree that banning high quality books is problematic because they can help our children tackle some of those really big questions of right and wrong. I really have observed in my own children that rumination on some parts of stories where people do the wrong thing. And I'm surprised when they'll bring it up like months later as a supporting point to why we don't do such and such thing. To this point, though, I was discussing this actual same issue with a lovely public school teacher who does have similar concerns of dropping quality books. But in a classroom setting, teachers can't be sure that the conversations about right and wrong are happening at home. Like, for example, Little House on the Prairie, it's drawn a ton of controversy. Ma uses derogatory terms towards Indigenous people. She also expresses a fear of these Indigenous people because they're coming to her house to collect rent. But doing a teeny bit of digging, we could present the issues facing those settlers at that time. Like, they were actually illegally squatting on Indigenous land. Now, we have to remember that Google wasn't around when Laura Ingalls Wilder was writing. She was writing from her family's experience. So yes, just reading an excerpt would seem quite inappropriate, but in context, with some supporting conversations, this could lead to better understanding.
Context is everything, and discussions about the contexts and settings of these potentially problematic books are important. But I think of how many times I've read books, or my children have read books, without the handholding and context laid out for them. And they're still able to figure out that the books are depicting completely different times and places, and what may have been acceptable, say in the Middle Ages or in the antebellum South, is not acceptable today. They can distinguish right from wrong. But I have another problem with this thought process, and it's not isolated with this public school teacher that you were talking to. It seems to be a sentiment of the entire public school system. And that is that the public school system and teachers are somehow responsible for how children are raised and what beliefs they should hold and value. I've spoken to many parents who argue that they send their children to public school for an education in the three R's and a few other subjects, but not to be indoctrinated in other beliefs and values, such as spirituality or a lack of spirituality or morality, or views that contradict personal beliefs and values. There seems to be a desire for a greater reach into homes than should be there. And whether we agree with every parent's idea of how children should be raised, or what discussions are or are not happening in the home, these things are private decisions. I'm not sure any of us want to live in a country where our government tells us what we can and can't do with our children. Of course, to a degree, I'm not speaking about things like abuse and neglect. But I think for the most part, parents want what is best for their children. Banning great literature that has so much to teach our children because we are concerned that parents are not having important discussions at home does not seem like a great solution.
That is a big question, though. Are public schools stepping over a boundary when they impart values to our children beyond the reading, writing, math? There have been instances where a shift in societal mindset has been to the benefit of society, like wearing seatbelts, drinking and driving. These changes were implemented because the kids were all in school together and it did spread a good message. So I don't completely agree. I think there's some times where it can be beneficial. The difference here, though, is that seatbelts are not an ideological in nature. They're not moral issues. It was an objective problem that people were not buckling up, and then we could see a direct link to car accident fatalities. In this case, though, choosing to eliminate books that have been enjoyed for generations and telling children and families they're not competent to decipher right from wrong, well, that's an inappropriate use of power. Removing classic books is a subjective endeavor. I have concerns that eliminating these books from our public sphere has longer-term ramifications than the people pushing this view have really considered. In this case, I think, or at least I hope, that banning classic books was done for the intention, like, to protect society. But it's really going to backfire, because if we take away exposure to differing points of view in narrative form, texts that have been enjoyed for many years, these stories are important to our great-grandparents, our grandparents, and sometimes going even further back. These stories are a part of who we are, where we've been. Removing them because we don't agree with some aspects is really missing the point of who we are as people. We are not perfect, and we and no author or book ever will be. There is too much to be gained from walking in other people's shoes here.
I could not agree more. Now, I know that many in homeschooling communities would agree with this sentiment about old books. But here is something that we don't always agree on. Are modern books all twaddle, lacking integrity, devoid of morality, and riddled with hidden agenda? Like the homeschooling mom that believed that modern books only contain human opinion and lacking truth. I actually found this opinion not to have much reasoning, because all writing, whether old or new, is written through human perspective. and all of it will be influenced by their beliefs and values. So I personally have loved several well-written modern books, and one benefit of modern books is the ease of language. We have to remember that when Charlotte Mason was assigning books to her students, the books were written in a language they could understand. Language and dialects have changed drastically over the last 100 years, and although there is a great value in reading books with older language, it's very difficult for inexperienced readers, young and old, to understand and appreciate them. There are different issues in the overall differences of values in general, but I think to block all modern books would be a mistake.
Yeah, on the opposite end of the spectrum, too, only using older books can give you a false sense of doing Charlotte Mason correctly, but actually, I think, missing the whole point. I think moms can fall prey to the beautiful vision of stepping back in time to simpler times, which may be more of an aesthetic preference and not a better education. And I'm going to be honest here, this is something that I've actually fallen for before.
I think I have as well.
There's one Charlotte Mason curriculum in particular, which I love. It's so beautiful. The CMEC, it emphasizes the use of the same books that Charlotte Mason would have chosen. The photos, the materials, they really harken back to recreating a similar atmosphere as that original group of children going through her schools. This particular vision can draw those of us wanting that true classical Charlotte Mason feel. And I really love the way they portray their curriculum. They have leather-bound books. They use plume quills. The little girls are dressed in beautiful homemade linen dresses. It just feels so pure and beautiful. But I suspect that if Charlotte Mason was alive today, she'd have staff sorting through the newest book releases every year. She would find high quality and engaging books that imparted ideas to her children and left them with a permanent imprint. She wouldn't have a set book list that was reused in perpetuity. I think there's definitely a benefit to a balanced approach of old and new books. Your children should read Plutarch, but they can also enjoy the Penderwicks or the Wild Robot series.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it as well. Another point I wanted to chat about is the difference between using old nonfiction literature as living books in subjects like science and history. I've looked through some of the book choices in other Charlotte Mason curriculum, like the CMEC, for example, which continue to use pretty old literature. And I wonder if some of the content is still relevant. Not only do they contain older language, but some of the facts have to be corrected over time. More up-to-date information might be more relevant for our children to learn. For example, we are finishing up a book called Onward. It's about the expedition of to the North Pole. And historically, Robert Peary was recognized and given the credit for this accomplishment. But in this book, we learned that an African-American named Matthew Henson played a big role in this, and Robert Peary would not have been successful without him.
Yeah, we also love that book. That was a great one. The conversation actually that it sparked around explorers and adventures that were not recognized, that continued in our house. We were reading an even newer book about climbing Everest. It's simply titled Everest by Alexandra Stewart. It's published in 2020, and my children were fascinated about the connections between Matthew Henson and Tenzing Norgay. Both men were crucial to the success of the climbs and exploration, but they weren't recognized because of the color of their skin. Charlotte Mason doesn't strike me as someone who would dogmatically want us to follow decade-old book lists. I think she wanted us to treat the children in front of us as complete humans requiring the best of ideas. Sometimes this is going to come from classics, and sometimes this is going to be a science book published last year. Actually, there's one science series I wanted to mention. It was published really recently. It's called Scientists in the Field, and it follows scientists working to solve problems like decline in bee population or reintroduction of the wolf population into Yellowstone National Park. These are modern books, but they really lead to kids caring about these issues. And as Charlotte Mason homeschoolers, isn't that the goal?
Yes, absolutely.
So now that we've opened the door to using newer books, we do have to clarify that twaddle is an important type of book to avoid.
And I think now is an important time to explain what we mean or what Charlotte Mason means by twaddle. For some people, it seems all modern books or novels are considered twaddle, but I don't think that's quite how it should be defined. So how would you define it?
Well, have you ever read a picture book to your children and found it has babyish language, no real point, the illustrations aren't artistic, it's just terrible concoctions made up on a computer. That would be twaddle. Did you grow up reading Babysitter's Club or Archie comics like I did? Although they were fun and I spent most of my childhood tucked behind one of those, they would also be twaddle. The vocabulary is simple, the ideas presented are very limited and shallow. There's no real plots that have potential to change your life. We also want to avoid those newer trade infotainment type books. All the information's really bite-sized, like chicken fingers. They're heavily photographed encyclopedia-type materials, and that's usually where they're sourced from, just little blurbs from encyclopedias. So they're really uninspiring. We want to find beautifully written books, rich in ideas, where the author is really passionate about the subject. To avoid twaddle, in particular with science books, we want to look for high-quality writing, up-to-date research, and preferably written in narrative form. You want to walk away feeling a connection to the issue that was presented. I do want to mention that although we can get better and better at identifying twaddle, I do still allow my kids to read it if they choose. In fact, I read twaddle myself. I remember at the end of one summer a few years ago, right before we started school, I collected all the titles from our home library that I believed were twaddle, or maybe even just not the best classics. I got a little bit crazy. And I boxed them up and I hid them. I was bound and determined that my kids would only read the best books. So that only lasted a few weeks because my kids kept bugging me for the books and sequels to previous books they'd read. So I unpacked them and put them back on the shelf. I'm now careful about selecting great books for our school reading and reading aloud, but I do give them some freedom to pick the rest within our family's values. How about you?
Well, I can completely understand that because kids can definitely have a way of breaking us down.
Yeah.
So for me, when I first started transitioning into a Charlotte Mason approach to homeschooling, and I had first heard of this term twaddle, I became pretty strict about it. But I realized that reading wasn't being enjoyed the way it used to. And I heard an episode from the podcast Read Aloud Revival, and in it, Sarah McKenzie was openly approving of twaddle, saying that it played an important role in helping our children learn to love reading. The issue in our home was that my children really loved graphic novels and didn't really want to read anything else. And I wanted my children to start forming their own pictures in their minds rather than someone else's depictions of the stories. So I began to allow one graphic novel a week. The rest had to contain no pictures or minimal pictures. Of course, I did make an exception for my youngest daughter. And I would assign a classic to be read that had to be narrated back. I would put a timer on for 30 minutes a day in which the classic had to be read, and the rest of the day, any reading could be their own free time and reading. As my children's tastes began to grow in reading, I found that I didn't have to use these rules surrounding their book choices anymore. They really had stopped reading graphic novels altogether. And because their tastes matured, they began to gravitate towards the great books. I found this with my older two daughters. And my 10-year-old is definitely leaning towards better books now and rarely asks for a graphic novel. But I definitely don't want to stifle their love of reading. So in a way, I felt like I needed someone to tell me that it was okay to read twaddle.
Yeah, that makes sense. But I didn't know you did that. Okay, other than hiding my lower brow books for a couple of weeks, I think you might be a lot stricter at your house. Would you share some of your favorite classic children's books?
Well, just to comment on the strictness, like the quote I shared in the last podcast episode, I believe that children's tastes are still developing. And so I may never have read some of the classics I read as a child and loved if I had the option of reading Archie comics. And don't forget, I am reading The Naughtiest Unicorn at bedtime.
Okay, I'll forgive you.
So I would say my number one favorite series of all time is The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, who also happens to be one of my favorite authors. It's an epic tale of good versus evil, in which you are drawn into a magical land through a wardrobe, along with four siblings, Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy Pevensey. C.S. Lewis has argued that these books were never meant to be allegorical, but one can't help but draw the lines between his books and theology. The next book, or books, I can't help recommending enough are by C.S. Lewis's best friend and confidant, J.R.R. Tolkien, who wrote The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings trilogy. Of course, they might not be entirely suitable for the younger readers, but my children have loved these books as much as I have. In these books, the most unexpected characters accomplish great things, all while experiencing terrible hardships and setbacks in this epic battle of good versus evil. We all want to be hobbits by the end of reading this series. And I also love to recommend The Wind and the Willows by Kenneth Graham. I think it's a must read in every homeschool. The adventures and misadventures of mole, water rat, badger, and the incorrigible toad will captivate your children's hearts, and Graham's lyrical writing style adds sophistication and depth that parents will love it as well. And the last one I'd recommend is Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. It is such a beautiful story about the March family. While the father is away at war, their mother, Marmee, holds the fort. She is a strong, wise, and compassionate woman, and she guides her four daughters' morals and characters. It's a story of love, loyalty, of being true to yourself. There are so many more books I could name, but I'll have to save that for another episode.
Yeah, I know. We could easily spend an hour or two trading just our top titles. But actually, since you mentioned Little Women, we just finished Little Men. Mm. It was amazing. One of my favorite parts was listening to how Joe, like grown-up Joe and Mr. Bear, educated all the children at the little school that they created. The kids also loved the mischief of the boys at the school. That was really fun. One book that I've cherished since my father read it to me is The Little Princess. This one really shows strength of character and kindness, even in the face of really difficult situations. Another one, now I know I'm stepping on toes, but one of my other ones I'm going to recommend here carefully is Huck Finn. This is an excellent but very controversial book. I would suggest this one's read aloud so that you can skip any language, and it does have some murdery scenes. But the moral questions that arise and the friendship between Huck and Jim, it's going to lead to so many important conversations in your home. I don't think this one should be skipped. This one we also followed up with watching the Disney version, the one with Elijah Woods, and that was a great movie. Another one that my fantasy-loving daughter and I really loved in the last year was The Little White Horse by Elizabeth Gouge. This is a more unusual one if you have a daughter or son that really likes mysterious, magical stories. It's a teenage girl as a protagonist, so maybe more girls. Fascinatingly, J.K. Rowling describes this as an influential book to her writing the Harry Potter series.
I never knew that. Those are all great reads. I think we'll have to borrow from each other.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, I think that concluding today's episode is not going to be cut and dry. I'm not quite sure we ended this particular debate, and I'm not even sure whether you and I even agree on some of these things. But I hope that we have been able to at least persuade some of you to consider old classics. They really have a lot of value to add in their richness of language, how they highlight values and morals by deeply contrasting good and bad, how they are filled with characters that help us better understand what it means to be human. And they really contain storytelling like no other. Modern books are really just adaptations of old books, I think, anyways. And for those of you who are opposed to modern books, I hope we have been able to persuade you to consider that they also hold value. Yes, it may require a little more screening on the parents' part, but there are some great modern books out there. Some of them are my very favorites. Many modern books offer some of the great classic storytelling, but with added themes and topics that are more relevant to children today and in a language that they can understand and holds their attention. And by this, I don't mean simplistic language, but without the use of words that just simply no longer exist today. I think that a good conclusion to end on is that if Charlotte Mason were here today, she would want us to read both old and new books, and she may even lean a little more towards the modern works in many subjects, or simply just to enjoy reading. Do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, I'd like to squeeze in some words from C.S. Lewis, if that's okay. It's a good rule, after reading a new book, never to allow yourself another new one till you've read an old one in between. Mm. Older children's classics have the advantage of being loved by many, and they allow us to live in another era. Newer books may be quite a lot easier to read. They have more accessible language and thought patterns that we recognize. But remember that familiarity may be limiting your ideas. They also have not stood the test of time. It's not to say they won't become classics, it's just that we don't know yet which books will enter the realm of cultural touchstone.
Those are all excellent points. Well, I think that about wraps up this episode. So I thank you so much for listening today.
Join us next time when we discuss how to get your kids to love reading.